all CEOs, me included, we don't actually know what we're doing.
They're all sharks, so all you got to do, though, is know shark behavior.
I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
We can capture all of the wallet share.
First place you start is with the product.
That's just the first nut.
This is the Capital Stack.
Hey, everybody. This is David Paul, the host of the Capital Stack podcast, where I talk to founders, entrepreneurs, investors, and authors about all things value creation in startups. Today, I've got a great honor of talking to Jerry Colonna. Jerry Colonna is by far one of the most revered executive coaches and life coaches for startup founders, probably the most well-respected name after Bill Campbell, who passed, and has been a pillar of stability and of structure for many, many wonderful men and women who have trek down the rocky road of startups. He's also a best-selling author of Reboot and now Reunion, which has hit the shelves in the last couple of weeks. Jerry, how are you?
I'm well, and I laugh because that's my infamous question. That's the question I use to get people crying. But I have to say, I don't think I've ever been called revered before. So I had to make a note of that one. I like that one.
Revered. I revere you. Yeah, no, I revere you.
I'm not sure my kids would revere me. You know, they spend a lot of time, or my wife, they do spend a lot of time rolling their eyes at me. But that was a very generous introduction. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I get that a lot too. And yes, you are known to make the strongest men and women cry, as said in many articles, by asking them the simple question, how are you? So Jerry, just give us the audience, if anyone who doesn't know who you are, a little bit about your background and how you got into deep work coaching.
Well, I'll cut to the second half of that and answer non-chronologically. I got into the work that I do through my own broken heart. And I think that that is a, we'll circle back to that in a moment, but I think some of the most important life changes that I certainly have gone through, if not others, has been to lean into that broken heart. But I think what you're referring to is the fact that for the early part of my adulthood, I was first a technology reporter in my 20s, and then in my early 30s, starting at 30, I became a venture capitalist and launched a firm in New York and spent 10 years doing that. Only to, at around 39, 40 years old, walk away from everything and tend to a deep and profound depression that led me to being the person I am today, revered as I am.
And so in some type of cataclysm, I think it was around 9/11, if I remember correctly, a lot of life events that brought you into executive coaching. How has your life paralleled, and how did you become, for the people that haven't read the book, how did you go through your experience of rebooting yourself, and what is rebooting yourself?
Well, just to give some specific details on that. In 2001, my then partner, Fred Wilson, and I decided to wind down our first firm, Flatiron Partners, the firm Flatiron Partners. He then later went on with great success to found Union Square Ventures. And I joined JP Morgan, who was our single limited partner. And it was really around the middle of 2002 that I had to confront the undeniable fact that I was massively depressed, and that changing firms wasn't doing it. It wasn't the thing that I needed. And so I decided not to renew my contract at the end of 2002. And then I wandered in kind of the desert of midlife. I was in therapy, thankfully, but I really started doing some very important work. I started studying Buddhism, for example. I started all sorts of different explorations. And it was through that period that I made the transition to becoming an executive coach. So it wasn't like 2001, I'm a VC, 2002, I'm a coach. It was more like 3 or 4 years, and it was a slow process. But once it started, it moved very, very quickly.
And in that discovery in your book, you have this poignant, I guess, phrase, radical self-inquiry as a starting point in this process. What is that, and how does one do that?
Well, I forgot to respond to your question about rebuilding, so I'll put both together. So my first book is called Reboot, Leadership and the Art of Growing Up. And I describe that period of transition that I was referencing as a kind of reboot button, a kind of restart, like everything that had worked before had ceased to work. And so I kind of just restarted the computer with a cold reboot. And I say that in a kind of quippy sort of way. It was a profoundly important time period. The kind of time period, the kind of things that I was doing that, in my view, most people don't do. And it was probably about 4 or 5 years after that process that I coined the term radical self-inquiry. And the reason I came up with that term was that I was trying to describe this very odd experience I was having, where I would go deep on, say, therapeutic techniques. I mean, I did art therapy, I did dance therapy, I did psychoanalysis. I mean, if it had therapy associated, I was doing it. But I was also journaling. And importantly, I was sitting in meditation. And in meditation, I wasn't just watching my breath. I was diving deep. And so I tried to describe this experience of self-inquiry. And the notion that it is radical links all the way back to our little quip about the question, how are you? The process that I'm describing is radical because we're so wired not to do it. We're so wired to not even ask ourselves, how am I doing right now? How am I feeling right now? What is actually happening to me? Or more specifically, my infamous question out in the web, out everywhere, how have I been complicit in creating the conditions I say I don't want? Meaning, how is who I am and the way I've grown up contributing to the things that I struggle with today, raising the consciousness of that so that I can then make conscious choices about how I would like to be? So, how is that for an answer?
It's really good. It's really good. And so, from looking at origins, right? Mm. So, I mean, when I read your book, you know, just this isn't about me, this is about you, but, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And, you know, after, you know,
Mazel tov, how long have you been sober?
16 years.
My goodness. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Long time.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
I'm proud of
Thank you. And, you know, because, in, you know, it's funny because you get sober and your life's supposed to be so much better because you're not drinking, but there's still so many, there's still just so many. I mean, like literally I'm still a monster. I just don't drink anymore. And right. I did another program called Adult Children of Alcoholics.
Yes. Been there.
Yeah. And that was, and I drew a lot of parallels from Reboot with ACA work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first of all, just on you, I love the fact that you identified as a recovering alcoholic. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the last line of my first book, Reboot, which was, and with that, I mastered the art of growing up. Mm-hmm. And what I see in that is the active present tense verb or adjective or adverb, recovering. Mm-hmm. Not recovered.
Yeah, no. Indeed, no.
and in the same way, it's like I don't consider myself a grown-up. Mm-hmm. I consider myself in the practice of growing up, just as perhaps you consider yourself in the practice of staying sober. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And in Adult Children of Alcoholics, I have six siblings. Each one of us has spent time either in the program or at least reading the original book and looking into each other and going, holy shit, this is us. Mm-hmm. And while none of us struggled with substance abuse, all of us struggled with the implications of substance mm-hmm. abuse and addiction. And in fact, one sister became a recovery facilitator and used yoga in her work with families of alcoholics, which, you know, God bless her soul. She's a bodhisattva, a real saint. Mm-hmm.
So in your travels of working with several founders and executives, do you find that the pathology that lies in the family of origin issues that causes so many issues in their grown-up life, in their trekking to create value within, you know, the world of business, is it a lot of the same story over and over again, just manifesting itself in different ways? What keeps these people in a childlike state?
Well, the painful work that you have done, the painful work that I have done, the for whatever reason, the defended nature of not doing the painful work, of not looking in the dark places, of not looking at that mind-fucking question of how have I been complicit in creating the conditions I say I don't want. That's what makes growing up and becoming an adult so hard. And to be clear, the first question that you implicitly asked was how, in a sense, how common is this? How often do I see this? And yes, you're right. Most of my work is focused on those who hold power, especially in business situations. But this is a universal experience. And what do I mean by that? You know, and I write about this in Reunion, my new book. One of the phenomena that I experienced when Reboot was released in 2019 was this repeated experience of people coming up to me. Now, as you know, I'm quite revealing of my own story, both in my first book and in my second book. And people would come up to me, people from a variety of backgrounds, and they would say to me something to the effect of, your story is my story. I'm thinking, for example, a woman I write about in Reunion, Joy Today Kingari, who is an immigrant from Zimbabwe to Ireland, who came up to me in Ireland and said to this white, straight, cisgender man from Brooklyn, "Your story is my story." I had to come to understand that so many people related to what I was writing about in Reboot because the underlying feelings and struggles are universal. So back to the core question. Yeah, this all shows up in a lot of people's adult expressions, especially when we're in the stressful situation of trying to be an entrepreneur or a leader or an investor. But it's not exclusively showing up for those people. I mean, sure. We've had plenty of politicians, for example, whose unresolved issues with dad result in them working out their issues by being patently aggressive and narcissistically absorbed. And we all pay the price when someone who has power is trying to avoid doing their work.
And so in your line of work, the solution to some of this is generally somebody putting the mirror up to your face and saying, where have you been complicit? Where are you responsible? And generally for that to happen, you have to have some kind of smack in the face, some kind of really painful experience to bring you down to that position.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of my experience working with Buddhist teachers over the years, you know, those who are not close to Buddhist practices can project onto a Buddhist teacher a kind of, we'll even use the term Zen-like to imply this sort of peaceful experience when a Zen Buddhist teacher is actually one of the fiercest people around. They will smack you in the head. You know, I remember working with a teacher who grabbed me by the ears one day. Literally, his face in my face, pulled my face towards him and said, "What is the nature of the mind?" and so, there's something very powerful in either a person or a life circumstance pulling you in by the ears and saying, "What is the nature of mind?" And if you think back to your own experience, there was something that happened that caused you to say, "Enough. Mm-hmm. I'm going to walk in. I'm going to sit in a circle." Whatever program you used, there was enough power in that moment to smack you in the head, to encounter what one of my Buddhist teachers once said in a blessing. He would say, "May you be bombarded by coconuts of wakefulness." Right? That's the calling. Can you be bombarded by coconuts of wakefulness so that you wake up and don't go back to sleep? Wake up, don't go back to sleep. And what is it that you're waking up to? You're waking up to the reality of how you may have been complicit in creating the conditions in your life you say you don't want, or how you may be avoiding saying certain things and acting out instead, mm-hmm. or how you may be refusing to hear what's being said around you. Mm-hmm. Or I heard this good question over the weekend, how you may be hearing something other than what actually people are saying, mm-hmm. and making up a whole story
sure.
about what they're saying. There's a kind of fierceness behind all of that. Again, think of that teacher pulling you in by your ears saying, "What is the nature of the mind?" Mm-hmm. Well, one of the natures of the mind, one of the ways the mind manifests is to delude yourself and think it's all your fault or it's never your fault. To think Correct. You're the worst person in the world or the greatest person in the world.
You're either turning to a child or a teenager, right?
There you go.
You know, you're going to be sulk or are you going to fight right. back? Right.
Or are you going to be an adult and take responsibility for that which is yours to take responsibility for? Not absorb all the guilt in the room, but take responsibility for what is really yours to take responsibility for.
So before we go into Reunion, right, which is your newest book, which I want to go deeper into, in the context, there's a lot of conversation, especially now, and you reference it a lot in Reboot, just the act of just founder burnout and investor expectations, founder expectations. Generally speaking, it's your founders give up a lot, you know, and it's a masochistic type of endeavor to become a founder at best. And there's an expectation. So how do you think about balancing that from an investor perspective? How would you coach investors like me to lead with the heart?
That's a great question. So I want to just acknowledge that the last few years have been pretty hard for investors as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ecosystem or venture-backed startups tends not to have a lot of empathy for folks. And, you know, sometimes investors have been complicit in creating the conditions they say they don't want. Mm-hmm. There's a reason the Twitter handle VCs congratulate themselves is so funny, right?
It's so good.
And it's so good.
It's so
okay?
Good.
So I want to acknowledge that. And I also want to acknowledge that it's been a hell of a roller coaster ride as well. Mm-hmm. So I'll answer your question this way. You know, we started doing boot camps 11 years ago, even before we launched Reboot the company. And very soon after launching our first boot camps, which were primarily focused on founders and CEOs of startup companies, we started doing boot camps for investors. And there was an exercise that we would do the first night of boot camp for the founders, in which we would share in a particular way the struggles that they were going through. When we did our first VC boot camp, we began doing the same exercise. And people started to look at each other and realize that they had a shared experience. Your story is my story. But the twist was the next day. And then the next day, we started to anonymously share the things that the founders were going through. And this had a very important effect, because not only did they see that your story is my story was true amongst the whole cohort of VCs sitting around the table, sitting around the circle, but that they shared exactly the same fears as the entrepreneurs that they were backing. And more, they realized that the pressure that they were putting on themselves, which stemmed from an anxious fear of failure, was coming out as an aggression that was making those entrepreneurs' lives worse. Mm-hmm. And if you combine that with the bullshit that VCs congratulating themselves so cleverly punctures, you get this aggressive, anxious, aggressive investor pounding a table, pointing a finger at an entrepreneur and telling them, you know what you should do? You should fill in the blank. And
it's
that
not
doesn't
a good
actually
look.
Help. It's not a good look.
Right.
Especially when the advice and counsel or the directions coming from the board are in conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. And they're getting board member whiplash. One guy says I should go deep here, and one gal says I should do this, and this is making things miserable. So the first thing I would say is to recognize that you're all in this together. Everybody's mm-hmm. job is to try to create magic. It really is. It's try to create something out of nothing. And the second task, equally important, is everybody should be responsible for self-soothing and managing their own anxieties.
Mm.
Because that's the part of growing up that those who have power have a moral responsibility to do. Self-soothe your anxieties. Do not make the people around you responsible for making you feel better. Then you can work together in a partnership to make magic. And I refer to magic. Any startup that succeeds beyond 2 years is magical. It's just
right, exactly.
'Cause it's so hard. It's just so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love that, that everyone needs to be responsible for themselves to self-soothe anxieties. And like, it's almost that the investors, you know, I feel like from my experience, and I haven't been doing this, you know, forever. I've been doing it for about 8 years, right? But, you know, my hang up is like, God, I just feel like founders are, you know, repeatedly dishonest. But now looking at it from this perspective, have they been conditioned to be dishonest because they've been told to medicate my anxiety?
Or have you been complicit in that?
Correct.
By you not being able to manage your fear of losing money, so they're always telling you
what
a lie.
Right.
They're exactly. telling you what you want to hear, not what you need to hear.
Exactly.
Right? And to be fair to you, that's not just a unique situation with you. When I first started doing this work almost 20 years ago, and I would encourage founders to be honest about what was going on, they'd look at me and say, do you really expect me to be able to raise money if I'm honest with investors?
Right.
Right. And
are you nuts?
you know, there's validity to what they're saying. And I mean, think about it, you know. First pitch meeting, you come in and say, yeah, I don't know if we're going to hit these revenue numbers. Are you going to actually seriously sit with them?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my former partner, Fred, used to tell this story that his old partner at Euclid Partners used to tell of an entrepreneur who came in with a business plan that showed that they were in 5 years, they were going to make $35 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And the investors at the time said, we can't invest in any business that if after 5 years, you're not hitting at least $50 million in revenue. So he went back, scrubbed the deck, scrubbed the business plan, came up with a new strategy, pitched it, got the funding, and 5 years later had $35 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He did what needed to be done in order to raise the funds, but was it a failure or was it a disappointment or was it a success?
Right? Mm-hmm.
And so he sold what he needed to sell
mm-hmm.
and was kind of dishonest with himself
mm-hmm.
and everybody else. Right. That's the, I would refer to that as the kind of spinning
mm-hmm.
that entrepreneurs seem to feel forced to do, to be able to get the capital to make magic.
Yeah. It's just, it's a feature, not a bug.
Indeed. And so maybe the problem is the system.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Maybe the problem, I mean, you know, if you raise capital from LPs, are you spinning to the LPs?
Of course. We have to go back and believe our book, right? I mean, we have to be optimistic.
Okay. I used to use a phrase all the time, pathologically optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which is a kind of delusional state of like, oh yeah, we're going to launch this business and we're going to take out Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're not.
Right. Yeah, no, it's never like, going to happen. Yeah.
You know, I mean, the only company that launched that could theoretically consider themselves as having taken out Walmart, and they didn't, was Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So stop.
Exactly.
Let's all be realistic about what we're trying to create and what the opportunity is. Let's lower expectations. Let's lower the demands. And let's imagine that a 40% return on capital is a good number.
Mm-hmm. Phenomenal number.
We accept that everybody's pitch deck is a 400% return.
Correct. Yeah.
Right?
Right, exactly.
It's like, stop.
Mm-hmm.
Stop. It's an asset class.
Mm-hmm. And it's been solved, by the way, right? Like, it's not like that we're reinventing the wheel here. Investing's
been solved. Right.
I mean, I literally have been like, that's what I've been kind of wrestling with. It's just like, why? Like, we're all fighting for the same piece of pie, offering the same thing in a different color. Like,
right.
Is this really like the thing, right, David? You know, like that we should be running at?
Right, 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 right. But I think, if I were starting over as an investor now, I would say stay focused on the magic. Stay focused on the fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the best relationships I've ever developed were with people that I invested with.
Right.
Even if they lost money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the industry can be, has been, and should be again.
Mm-hmm.
It should be about people getting together, bringing the best of their strengths to the table to try to do something magical, which is create a startup that can last more than 2 years. That's fucking phenomenal.
Exactly. Exactly. And everyone's going to mature and learn so much.
That's right.
Right, wrong, or indifferent. Like everyone's going to like learn 20 years of stuff in those 2 years.
That's right. And the real payoff, the real icing on the cake is a return on capital.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that that's not your first objective.
Right.
Right. But to understand that this is a risk-reward ratio that has to be managed, especially the earliest you enter the business of investing. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, closing the chapter on Reboot, what was the genesis of Reunion, and what is that?
So, in a sense, with Reboot and with the work that I've done over the years, I've kind of set myself to a high bar, and the high bar is this notion that better humans make better leaders. It's a central premise of my first book. It's a central premise of everything that we do. So in a sense, by extension, the work I do in the world is to try to help people grow up and be a better human. Okay. In the summer of 2020, during the middle of the pandemic, one of my fiercest critics, my daughter, Emma, as is often the case, because she's fiercely focused on social justice, began protesting the murder of George Floyd. And one night, she was part of a protest that began in Brooklyn at Barclays Center and made its way over the Manhattan Bridge on its way to Lower Manhattan, to the headquarters of the NYPD. And there were about 5,000 people in this protest. And at one point, they were sort of middle of the bridge when police from Brooklyn began approaching behind them, and police from Manhattan began approaching. And they were hemmed in. And my daughter started texting about being pepper sprayed. And it was kind of like we were talking about being pulled in by your ears. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of the mind? And in that moment, it was kind of like this in Buddhism, we'd say a pointing out instruction, where a fierce teacher is asking you to look at something that you'd really rather not look at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in effect, what my daughter did for me. What she caused me to look at was not just how have I been complicit in creating the conditions I say I don't want, but how have I, Jerry Colonna, been complicit in and benefited from the conditions in the world I say I don't want to see?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a mind fuck.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough question.
And that you mean systematic racism?
In systematic oppression, in systematic othering, in which racism, whether it's anti-Black racism, anti-Asian racism, is actually a subset of a deeper phenomena, which is anti-migrants, anti-Semitism, or Islamophobia, or the denial of human and medical rights to women and trans folks. How have I, this guy who sets himself up to say better humans make better leaders, to what degree have I called into question my own work to do on that question? And more important, what is the role of a leader, someone who holds power, whatever their identity, in looking at the question of what we as a society tend to do to people who are not perceived to be in the dominant space? This is beyond black-white racism. Mm-hmm. This is in this zone of how do we treat those of us who are on the margins. Mm-hmm. I just finished last night a fabulous book called Welcome the Wretched. And it's a history of the United States' relationship with immigration. And it's a profound exploration of the legislation and the structures. How did we get to where we are today, which is a freaking mess on the mm-hmm. southern border of the United States? How did we get here? And more importantly, where is the empathy mm-hmm. that should be embedded in our policies? How do we get to a state where it's normal that there is a mass shooting at a school? How do we get to there? What? Why are we so afraid of the other, however they identify, that it's okay to have 400 plus million guns in a country with 330 million people? How do we get here? Mm-hmm. And I'm not debating Second Amendment rights. I'm not debating this. I just want to open up a dialogue that says, what is a business leader's responsibility in a world where we are literally killing each other?
And that starts with the radical self-inquiry. And then how does that evolve?
Well, let's put it this way. If you feel the moral responsibility to radically inquire within so that your unconscious business doesn't hurt people around you, the natural extension of that is to look even further outward. Mm-hmm. How has the history of my ancestors shown up in the world as it is right now? How have the people who have been left off of my family tree, for example, as one of my colleagues and one of the contributors in Reunion, she wrote, there are three people who wrote essays in the afterword. And one of my colleagues, Virginia Bauman, writes in her essay about her family's obsession with their family tree, going all the way back to Switzerland. And she asked a profound question. What happened to her queer ancestors? Mm-hmm. Are we going to pretend that they didn't exist? Mm-hmm. Because it didn't fit a religious norm? This is hard work. This is work that's actually harder than the hard work I ask people to do in Reboot. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to live up to my daughter, who once said to me, Dad, it's not enough to be an ally. You have to be a co-conspirator. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to be the ancestor that my descendants deserve, I have to be willing to look at myself and my role in the world at large, even though it's painful.
Surely, especially today. I mean, to lean on really progressive type principles in a world where, you know, there's a country that's half conservative.
I understand how these kinds of questions and assertions, and, you know, I will, I will admit, I'm as progressive as they come. Some might even describe me as a commie pinko. So acknowledged, okay?
Right.
But, David, especially today, not just because the rhetoric is so intense. I mean, fuck it. Somebody's going to call me woke. Big fucking deal. I'm from Brooklyn. Okay.
Yeah.
Who the hell cares? Call me whatever you want to call me. Babies are dying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I repeatedly say this because I don't know how bad it has to get for people to say what we're doing isn't working. And more importantly, who benefits from, let's call it, the left and the right? Who benefits when the left attacks the right and the right attacks the left? You know who benefits? The people who are in power right now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're left or right.
Agreed.
Attacking the other side ideologically doesn't solve problems. Period. And I'll say it again. Attacking the other side doesn't stop babies from being fucking shot on their last day of school in fourth grade, when all they should be caring about is how they're going to spend their summer, not mm-hmm. watching a cousin gunned down or a teacher gunned down, as what happened in Uvalde, Texas. And it does not take much imagination to see the linkage between our dreadful fear of the other person and our need to allow a 20-year-old or however he was, mentally unstable kid, access to a gun, to an assault weapon. That's the world that we are in. You know, when I wrote this book, I didn't imagine Uvalde, Texas. When I started writing this book, I didn't imagine a war in the Middle East where each side can be accused of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the fuck?
I know. I mean, like, totally. I mean, absolutely insanity.
Right? I didn't imagine it would actually get worse.
Right.
And all I feel is a moral responsibility to pick my head up and say, this doesn't work. And not to pretend that I have some sort of superpower human answer to the problem. I don't. I just know that doing nothing doesn't help.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the trouble is that people have, it's fucked up without a doubt.
Amen, brother.
Yeah. I mean, amen. And nobody thinks that there's like kids should be mowed down based on some archaic law that was formed and now is being used as some type of, boundary. Like, oh, you can't cross this because what else are they going to take? But that's the issue, is that we really have all this compounding resentment about, well, you did this, but I understand that's wrong. But what about this? And
right. What did the Bible teach?
It's just too entrenched.
An eye for an eye.
Right.
Right. An eye for an eye leaves the world blind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You want to read another powerful book? One Nation Under Guns. Look at the relationship between this distortion of the Second Amendment and its relationship to this fear of the other. It's a powerful, moving dialogue that helps explain how is it that mentally unstable people can get their hands on assault weapons. I mean, just that question.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There, I don't know anybody, including sportsmen who use guns all the time, who say, yes, a mentally unstable teenage boy should have access to weapons that can shoot hundreds of bullets a minute. Nobody says that.
Nobody says that. But what's the straw man behind that? Because obviously there's a reason why people are so entrenched with it. Like, what does the book say?
The book, One Nation Under God?
Correct. It's, you know, I doubt it's everyone's a redneck and, you know, they want their guns. Yeah.
It's not.
By the way, I'm not a gun owner and I don't like guns, but, you know, I'm just curious.
Read the book. It's a very complex book and it comes at it from a legal standpoint, a historical legal standpoint, and looks at over 125 years of rulings and how they shifted from an understanding of what the Second Amendment was about and how that has been morphed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Look, it's too complex for me to summarize in the brief time that we have, but here's the statistic. Since 2020, the number one cause of death for children in the United States under 17 is gun violence.
Wow.
How is this acceptable?
No.
Okay. And what is it that, because this is the key question, what is it that we who hold power in particular realms, what is our moral responsibility? As I say in the book, it is not up to us to heal all that ails the world, but we are not at liberty to ignore what ails the world. And more important, we can heal more than we pretend. You know, there's a long history of business leaders standing up for what's right. Early in my career as a reporter, I did a series of articles on a company called Control Data Corporation. You're too young to remember them. They used to exist. They were part of the original group of companies that built mainframe computers. And somewhere around 1967, 1968, the leadership at Control Data was looking at the riots that were happening in the streets. Riots in Watts, riots in California, riots in New York. And they answered a call to action from the NAACP or the United Negro College Fund, I can't recall which. And the call to action was, you can't do business in a community that's burning.
Mm-hmm.
And so they located many of their U.S.-based plants in areas that were economically challenged. They provided jobs and careers in communities that were struggling. We have done this before. There's a long tradition of business leaders taking a stand for social issues, even at the risk of being accused of being woke.
Mm-hmm.
Who the fuck cares?
Exactly.
You know, your story is my story. You know, I'll touch upon a point. You're a recovering sober person. How many people in businesses are like you?
I would say a great deal. Yeah, a great deal.
Okay. You're human.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost. You know, we talked about creating magic with companies. You know what's magical? To create a profitable business that creates a great return on investment that also sees the humanity of the people in the business. These are not opposing forces.
Mm-hmm.
As I often joke, you can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You can build a profitable business that treats people well, that actually cares about the environment, that cares about the community, a community that may be burning right now.
Last question, because, you know, where do you see, I mean, it is, I see how reunions, you build off of reboot. Where do you feel like the next iteration, the next book, the next, you know, area of deep exploration is for you?
It's on my dry erase board right there, which is where a book starts for me. It's still being marinated, but there is a third book that I'm working on. that really looks to be an extension of this work. Because if we pull all the way back, it's still all the way about working on oneself. It's about being the grown up, being the adult that we're called to be. Mm-hmm. This is part of my work in trying to be the ancestor my descendants deserve. When I leave this earth, and that will happen because no one ever gets out of here alive, right? Jim Morrison saying, what I want to leave behind is enough questions to get people talking about the things that really matter in the world. Because ultimately, that's what a coach does, is just ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Jerry, thank you so much for coming on.
David, it was a delight. Thank you for reading both books and taking the time to invite me.
Absolutely. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. If you would like to read Reboot or Reunion, they are available at Amazon. If you want to go and look at how you can reboot yourself and become an adult and become a much more self-reflected, self-actualized person, and have a much more kind of more meaningful, stable life as a human. What's your website, Jerry? How do you get in touch?
Reboot.io.
Reboot.io. And if you like what you heard, please subscribe, tell a friend, and we drop an episode every week. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Capital Stack Podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing. David Paul is the founder and general partner at DWP Capital. All opinions expressed by David and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of DWP Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. David and guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed on this podcast.